mobile staff, mobile care. We've got five presenters on a fairly wide range of topics, really, which I think demonstrates kind of the issues that the working group have tussled with for a number of years, that migration and TB is a complex issue, and it's not just related about patients migrating, but the staff that migrate, etc. So hopefully the five presentations will give you a flavor of migration and TB and its complexities, and trying through it to also weave together some relationship to the conference theme about strengthening health service resources, especially health staff. So, do you want to introduce?
Yes, do I want to be introduced? Hi, my name is Liliana Garcia. I'm with the Migrant Clinicians Network in the U.S. based out of Austin, Texas. We have a bridge case management program that assists people in under care move from one location to another, both domestically and internationally. So I'm really excited to get to work with Fraser.
As usual, this forum is quite informal. I say often the chairs are also presenters. I say we try to keep it quite informal, so please join into the spirit of it.
Yes, well, let me introduce Fraser for you, please. He's a UK-trained public health doctor. He has significant clinical TB training with Tibetan refugees in North India for the late 1980s, the early 1990s. He's worked for 10 years with international NGOs, mainly in South Asia, in the TB control programs. Since 2002 with the WHO in India, he's been working with the revised National TB Control Program of the government and in India.
Very much this morning, I would like to try and just give a very quick overview, leading on from what the special envoy last night, Dr. Sampaio, was talking about. One of the facets of TB control now is being increasingly recognized as the actual problem of health service staff migration or health service staff lack of. What I will try and do here is specifically looking at migration of healthcare workers and actually specifically about doctors, because we seem to have got more information on the doctors' migration than other healthcare workers. And we have our first problem.
Error?
Yeah. Instructions yesterday were minimal. As was being said last night by the special envoy, it is a fairly logical statement that if we are trying to deliver quality healthcare, we actually need a health service which is fully staffed with qualified staff. And there are many examples that show the positive relationship of staffing with healthcare outcomes. Some examples that have been given are immunization coverage, child and maternal survival, and also the outreach of primary care. There are also negative examples where, with staff cutbacks, often due to so-called health sector reform, actually you can see certain health status reducing. The one example that is given is child malnutrition has increased in some countries when health sector has reduced staffing levels. And actually, over the last few days, there has been a series of meetings with the Stop TB Partnership, looking actually at kind of the progress in TB control implementation, and specifically looking at the implementation of the new WHO Stop TB strategy. And one of the constant factors and one of the constant limiting constraints that was mentioned by all the high burden countries is actually human resource constraints, whether there is a lack of staff or a lack of trained staff. But this was a constant factor that was being mentioned by the countries that is going to be a major limiting factor in implementation of the full Stop TB strategy. But so kind of lack of numbers. As was mentioned last night, if you look at where the disease burden is, and if you look at the number of healthcare workers, they are inversely related. So that sub-Saharan Africa has 4% of global healthcare workers, but it has 25% of the global disease burden, whereas the Americas have 37% of the healthcare workers with only 10% of the global disease burden. It has been estimated by WHO that there is a shortage worldwide of almost 4.3 million healthcare workers. And most of these are in countries that already are struggling to provide basic healthcare services. And 57 countries, most of them but not exclusively in sub-Saharan Africa, have been designated as countries that have critical shortage of healthcare workers, to a tune of around 2.4 million healthcare workers. And I'll explain a little bit more what I'm meaning in about critical shortages. Just to put it graphically, which often is much easier to see, this is the same thing turned into graphical form. It is pretty obvious that there is a very disproportionate distribution of disease and healthcare workers, with the Americas having a huge circle, and Africa, Southeast Asia, and Eastern Mediterranean, very small numbers. In terms of critical shortages, it has been estimated that you need 2.5 healthcare workers per 1,000 population to have any chance of achieving the Millennium Development Goals related to health. As you can see here, the African continent falls short of even that minimum healthcare workers. And if you see here, healthcare workforce at the 2.3 per 1,000 is not service, just service providers. It is also the health management and support workers. So that even if you add in managers and other support workers, Africa does not come up to the basic minimum level required. If you look at Southeast Asia, although the 4.3 looks better, it varies in country to country. This is the WHO regional figures. And within each region, there are many different countries. So Africa has 46 countries. Southeast Asia has 11. Western Pacific, a lot more. I can't remember. I think it's about 50-odd. So that within the regions, there is wide variety and variability between the countries. But still, at 4.3, Southeast Asia is also lacking many frontline staff. If you look at where the critical shortages are at its worst in terms of the regions, in terms of percentage, Africa actually is far, far the worst situation, as has been said by many speakers already over the last day or so. As you see, I have the estimated shortage actually outweighs the number of staff that are actually working in Africa today. If you look, however, at Southeast Asia, although the proportion is not as great in terms of the shortfall, the actual numbers are far greater, obviously due to the greater population in the Southeast Asian region. But if you look at that, between Africa and Southeast Asia, it's estimated that they are short of 2 million healthcare workers today. If you put it on the map, this is what you see. If you then look at the map of TB incidence, the purple and the red countries, again, are those that have the critical shortage of staff. So most of Southern Africa, a lot of Southeast Asia. Just looking at some of the generic health workforce issues, and what I've learned in the last few years talking to many program managers especially, these do seem to be general issues in all high-burden TB countries. Bar maybe the impact that HIV/AIDS is making on healthcare workers. But generally, everybody is saying there is not enough numbers. That seems to be backed by the previous slides. But one of the other issues is that in many countries, although the numbers may be there, they don't actually have the adequate skills to provide even the basic services. And certainly with a Stop TB strategy, we are expecting peripheral level workers to do much more complicated activities than was previously expected of them under the basic DOT strategy. What you also find is there is often a very uneven distribution of staff, so that again, even though the numbers may be there, and actually they may be trained, but they are not always in the right place. There is often a very obvious division between rural and urban areas, with most of the highly qualified staff being in the urban areas. And in many countries, I think we have to accept that the actual conditions that the staff work in are not particularly favorable for good activities, whether it be policy or just practice. There is often very poor or very unclear career structure. Working conditions are not often very good. pay is often quite low, especially in the public sector, so that many countries are losing staff not only from the rural to the urban areas, but from the public to the private sector. Certainly, my experience in India is that many doctors, the majority of the doctors, are actually in the private sector. All of these obviously leading to quite low morale and motivation. I know some places, actual conditions in the workplace are not very safe. And something that I think the TB community is really now picking up as we actually look at human resource issues is also that often supervision may be in place, but it's not very supportive supervision. It's very number crunching or blame finding. And obviously, in many countries, there is the high attrition due to the impact of HIV/AIDS on the healthcare workers as well as the general community. And then, obviously, migration in many countries is draining what limited resources a country has away from those areas that have the greatest need. And really, kind of, why are the healthcare workers moving? Well, from the previous slide, it's pretty obvious why many of them do move. However, it is quite complex, as are the patterns of migration. So as I was saying, even in a low-income country, there is often a migration from rural areas to the urban areas, from the public sector to the private sector, or not even migration from the public sector, but just straight entry into the private sector. And obviously, there is a great loss of healthcare workers from low-income to high-income countries. And the so-called push factors are fairly obvious. People are seeking a better life and a better livelihood elsewhere. And this is provoked often by the discontent or the dissatisfaction with their working conditions in country. Obviously, information now is much more widely available that there is the existence or availability of better paid, better conditioned jobs elsewhere. And certainly with globalization occurring, there is more facilitation, I think, is the most diplomatic word, of actually people to migrate in the health field. This actually seems to be a global policy that people can move. Unfortunately, most people move from the area of great need to those areas that have more staff, although have health needs, but are different. And this is the last one, that in many of the high-income countries, there is a growing unmet demand for healthcare workers due to many factors. And when you actually look at the numbers, it actually is quite startling. I saw this data kind of about a year ago, and obviously being British, it didn't strike me as too surprising, apart from the sheer numbers. Certainly when I was a junior doctor in the hospital that I worked, which was in the grimy north of England, and Peter Davis will know Wigan, the laugh says it all. This was a grimy, industrial, northern city. The vast majority of doctors that I worked came from the Indian subcontinent. So when you see the figures, it's not surprising, but they are quite startling that in America, one quarter of the doctors are actual graduates from outside America. In Britain, it's 28%. Canada, 23%. Australia, 26%. The data ranges from 1999 to 2002. One of the difficulties is actually getting hard data, but in terms of doctors, it is easier because often they have to be strictly registered, so this data is quite sound. But what is interesting is that then when you look at where these so-called international medical graduates are coming from, US, UK, are predominantly recruiting them from low-income countries. Canada and Australia, little bit less, but still a great deal of recruitment from low-income countries. And if we look at which countries are providing these doctors, again, it is quite fascinating. In the US, India is the biggest contributor of international migrant medical graduates, at 40,000 doctors. 1 in 20 of the American medical workforce actually is an Indian graduate. The so-called US MIGs are American citizens who have gone outside of America to graduate and come back. But then next, the Philippines. Next, Pakistan. So in the top four are three of the high burden countries in terms of TB. UK, same picture. Who contributes the biggest number? India. But now it is nearly 11% of the British medical workforce are contributed by Indian. Quite interestingly, the second largest group comes from Ireland. Again, a country that until very recently has had mass migration of all workers. But again, you look further down, Pakistan, South Africa, Nigeria, all TB high burden countries. However, that's just numbers. Obviously, India, being the size of the country or continent that it is, it's in some ways not surprising to see that it features very highly. But the gentleman that I took the data from has done this kind of so-called emigration factor. Now, the emigration factor, the last column, is doctors in recipient countries divided by doctors in recipient countries plus doctors in the sending country times 100, i.e. what is the proportion of those graduates that are working outside of the country. And when you look, it's quite surprising to see the countries rearranged. But if you look at the bottom, which just sneaks into the screen, India, Nigeria, Pakistan, Ethiopia, Philippines, South Africa, all high burden countries are there, with still very high factors, 10, 11, 16, 18, still contributing a huge proportion of their medical graduates. But if you look at the top of the list, kind of other countries, Jamaica, a huge proportion of their medical graduates are actually working outside. Haiti, a country that, my understanding, has virtually great problems providing any sort of service, and yet a huge proportion of their doctors are actually working outside. Then Ghana, then Sri Lanka. If you think about these countries, there are many, many different issues that are probably driving the medical graduates out. Probably low pay, bad conditions is universal, but some countries have civil strife. Others have other issues to deal with. Again, quite surprising to see Ireland so high on this list. Obviously, being British, actually not too surprising, I know, but quite shocking to see a country like Ireland so high. If you look at in terms of regions, going back to the first one, those that have the most burden of disease are also actually contributing the highest proportion of migrating medical graduates. So sub-Saharan Africa comes top. So the continent that has the worst staffing problems is actually contributing proportionally the highest number of medical graduates, and then the Indian subcontinent. And then, quite surprisingly, the Caribbean comes next. But taking the first two, that is a major kind of finding, an issue that the global community needs to look at. However, obviously, I have, and many people argue, that migration of doctors is not a bad thing for the sending countries. That actually, well, obviously from the recipient country's point of view, it's good, because you actually should be improving and increasing your healthcare service delivery for your own populations. There is, and it has to be accepted, a huge amount of money that is sent back by these graduates and other healthcare workers to their own countries. And some people will say this is a good poverty reduction strategy. And actually some sending countries, I know the Philippines, actually sort of grooms a certain proportion of their medical graduates for export. We can debate that one over coffee. There is the other one that they talk about, well, they will get better training. They will become more skilled. That's true. But in brackets is the most important thing, if they return. If they don't return, that skill transfer does not happen. The costs, I think, are much more tangible. Who trains these people? Well, it's the low-income countries. They invest their money in training these staff, and then they lose them. There is a huge investment in education. So, and this is not my terminology, this is a WHO terminology written in the book. There is a perverse subsidy of healthcare in high-income countries by low-income countries. They train the staff, and then they lose them. And obviously there is the loss of the human capital. These are skilled, gifted, often ambitious people. That is a great loss to the countries. So that this word I see is coming into kind of UN parlance again about global solidarity. I think it has to be recognized that especially if we are to achieve any of the Millennium Development Goals, but more specifically for us, the TB-related ones, and if we are to implement the Stop TB strategy, it has to be recognized that actually there is a health workforce crisis in many low-income countries. And actually this is going to require international solidarity and international assistance. So although the nations themselves have to do a great deal, there needs to be a lot of international assistance. Partly knowledge and learning, transfer of knowledge, transfer of skills, not export of people to be trained, but actually export of that knowledge and technology to those countries. Cooperative agreements where actually donors actually recognize this as an issue, and when they provide assistance, it is built in that they are going to build human resource capacity in those low-income countries. And the responsive to the workforce crisis is, yes, well, developed countries may have their own workforce crisis, but don't poach them from the low-income countries. Actually have some ethical recruitment. And many countries, and I'm sure kind of Peter Davies can tell us more about the UK policy, because I'm told that the UK has a much more ethical recruitment policy now of medical graduates. It has to be recognized, however, that there has to be this balance. There is the freedom of movement of individuals to pursue work elsewhere. However, that needs to be balanced with the health needs of the countries themselves. So nations themselves, the low-income countries, need to actually think carefully about their own policies and how they can actually retain staff. And this may mean changing the way of education and recruitment. Actually, kind of much training in the low-income countries is not actually tailored to the disease patterns or the available technology. And maybe this is a factor. If you train doctors on how to use high technology that is only rarely available in their own country, you may actually just drive them out of that country. And maybe that needs to be rethought. And as was said yesterday from President Sampaio about Ethiopia, maybe we need to rethink on who needs training, and on what they need training. It has to happen. Working conditions for the healthcare workers in low-income countries must improve. And there's a whole range of things. It's not just pay for the staff themselves. Many staff, certainly in my discussions with staff in India, many staff move from the rural areas, not for themselves, but for their families, in terms of education or housing. So there are many factors that need to be improved, not just the working conditions per se for all the healthcare workers, which is important, which is about salary, which is about career actual patterns and actual good management of the staff, but also issues around improved living conditions for the families. And also, low-income countries should look at mechanisms on how to facilitate the return of migrant workers from, say, America or Britain. It does happen, but often it is quite difficult for them to fit back in, especially into the public sector in many countries, if they return. For the high-income countries, well, there is a need of adopting responsible recruitment policies. I know in Britain that we are meant to be training more doctors, but obviously there is a time lag between starting training of new graduates and actually having them in post. So in the meantime, there needs to be a close look at the recruitment policies in high-income countries and have a more responsible and ethical recruitment policies. And more directly, obviously recipient countries have a great role to play in assistance to low-income countries, both in terms of development assistance for health, but making sure that that assistance does build capacity on the human. Just build buildings and provide pieces of equipment or drugs. This again has been a common theme. There is often money to buy equipment, to buy drugs. Often the staff are forgotten. No staff, no service. And obviously, there is already direct human resource support from high-income countries through many directions. Staff do go for humanitarian disaster relief. There is disease eradication efforts from many countries. And also, there are many international NGOs that are working. This is a form of direct human resource support. But however, there needs to be a much more deep thinking on how this actually is provided. And just to conclude, I say, for many of us in the WHO, I say this year has been a very mixed year, obviously with the untimely death of Dr. Lee. But again, I kind of just to leave kind of one of his statements. We have to work together to ensure access to a motivated, skilled and supported health worker by every person in every village, everywhere. And I must admit, I didn't know next year's World TB slogan until President Sampaio announced it last night, but some of the words seem to ring through everywhere, everybody. Thank you. I would like to acknowledge, and unfortunately, kind of, we had hoped that Dr. Mullen would be here to present. Many of the data I presented is actually from his work in a number of papers. It is not usual that the chair of sessions also do presentations, but unfortunately he was not able to come here. But I would like to acknowledge him greatly for a lot of the data provided. I would be failing in my own duty if I didn't plug the WHO World Report from this year. However, actually, it is a very important document in terms of human resource, and I would encourage all of you to actually have a look at it. Much of the data and the slides and the maps come from that that publication itself.
Okay. Thank you so much, Fraser. If it's all right, we'd like to move ahead with our next speaker so that we can then have everybody sit and accept questions, unless you have something burning and we can't let Fraser step away from the microphone. In this way, we can assure that we get through all of our presenters, and then we can let everyone have a chance. We're at 30 after, dear.
Okay, we'd like to invite our next speaker, Yasin Yezim, who from her very brief bio data is a sociologist and program coordinator of the ITAP program in Istanbul, TB and AIDS program for immigrants.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. I feel privileged to be here to talk about TB and immigration. My first goal will be to keep you awake during my presentation and myself as well. And my second goal is to stimulate international NGO support. I will go through this presentation outline, starting with basic demographic indicators and ending with prospects. This is a basic demographic indicator. Since it's clear and everyone can see, I don't want to repeat out loud, but the thing is, this is the actual Turkey map, and this map is still in use in my country, although the Greater Middle East plan of Mr. Bush has changed a lot lately. I would like to begin my presentation with a quote from Peter Stalker. In a world of winners and losers, the losers do not simply disappear. They seek somewhere else to go. Turkey, known as the country of emigration, over the last two decades became one of the prime transit routes for migrants and asylum seekers striving to enter EU countries. Turkey's unique location at the crossroads between Europe and Asia, its expanding economy and political stability have attracted many economic migrants as well as those who flee from ethnic violence or war in regions ranging from Iran, Iraq, to Sudan and Somalia. Moreover, Western countries' stringent entry procedures and increased border controls played a part in the recent increase in the migration flow. According to official data, around two-thirds of the total migrants enter Turkey legally, whereas one-third enters illegally. In this illegal category fall forced migrants, those are forcibly displaced, and economic migrants and migrants who fled because of economic hardship. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, estimates that roughly 270,000 migrants per year flow Turkey per annum, although some experts say this figure is much more higher. The term refugee is a commonly used term for displaced person, causing confusion between the general class of everyone who has left their home and the subgroup of legally defined refugees who enjoy specific international legal protection. The 1951 Geneva Convention is the key legal document defining who is a refugee, what his or her rights are, and what constitutes the legal obligations of the relevant states. According to Geneva Convention, refugee is any person who, owing to a well-founded fear of being persecuted on the grounds of nationality, race, religion, political opinion, or social group, is forced to flee his or her home when the state authorities are unable or unwilling to protect him or her. The convention was written in response to Second World War European victims and therefore only addressed the plight of European citizens. In recognition of the fact that non-Europeans are not avail themselves to this protection, the 1967 protocol removed the geographical and temporal restrictions from the convention. Turkey ratified both the 1951 convention and the additional protocol, but maintained the geographical reservation. Therefore, the non-European applicants are dependent on United Nations High Commissioner of Refugees for deciding refugee status determination procedures. Turkey, in practice, only provides non-European refugee applicants with 3 months residence permits, subject to extension, which does not allow legal employment after the applicant registers with the police at one of the 24 satellite cities scattered throughout the country. The whole RCD procedure, including or excluding the resettlement in a third country, can take between 1.5 and 5 years, sometimes even longer, and with all the time the applicant being in semi-legal status in the country. With respect to social rights and socioeconomic status, Turkey suffers from high unemployment and has a weak social service system, which is primarily available to Turkish nationals. Therefore, the services and resources are extremely limited compared to the countries recognizing migrant and refugee rights. Access to residence permits is almost impossible since the Turkish law on foreigners does not provide the right to residence. Therefore, the immigrant population is at the mercy of landlords who are willing to rent to illegals. The landlords charge inflated rents for a room in a dilapidated house with no kitchen and the only source of water being the communal toilet tap in exchange for taking the risk. To pay the rent, the primary tenant is forced to live up to 30 people in a room, sometimes taking turns sleeping due to lack of space. The living conditions are unsanitary, damp, and conducive to spread of disease with insects, with no heat, and with small LPG tubes for cooking. In order to put you a clear picture, I added some photographs of the refugees. These are some. This is a kitchen on the left-hand side. The sofa is being used as a kitchen. And this is very damp, humid place. And this is a toilet, for instance, on the right-hand side. As the Turkish state is scared of the draw factor, temporary refugee residence permit do not allow work. Left with no other option, they find work in the informal sector doing odd jobs like cleaning or carrying boxes for store owners or for construction sites. in informal sectors, as I've said, as domestic or piece work in light industry or street vendors. They often work for food or for a little cash with no insurance, with ill treatment by employers and for sub-minimum wages. It should be noted that the housing and the income earning activities are not unique to them, but exist in a continuum of coping strategies of all in poverty-struck neighborhoods. These are more pictures. Education is another problem due to the language hurdles and the requirement of valid residence permits for enrollment. Primary education is compulsory and free in Turkey. However, in practice, even Turkish public schools ask for administrative fees and are reluctant to accept refugees' children. Therefore, school attendance is minimum. Only a handful of international and national NGOs provide social assistance and financial support under the constraints of budget shortfalls. It is noteworthy that the majority of NGO activities addressing immigrants are run by Europeans and North Americans in Turkey. And interestingly, local and foreign church organizations are far more active than mosques. These are the names of major NGOs: the Refugee Legal Aid Program of Helsinki Citizens Assembly, Istanbul Catholic Migration Commission, ICMC, Caritas, Istanbul Inter-Parish Migrants Program, and International Organization for Migration. There are several national NGOs working on ad hoc basis. Many reports globally reveal that asylum seekers and refugees encounter greater difficulties in accessing to health care. According to Muslim Dares 2005 study, access to health care, as you see, ranks first among the difficulties women refugees faced, let alone the difficulties that the illegal immigrants have. Because most are illegal, fear of arrest makes the majority cautious of going to hospitals. The poverty makes even getting transport money difficult. This real financial concern is combined with the reception at health facilities, where the lack of cultural understanding on both sides makes it very hard to communicate. Some turned away or threatened with arrest. Therefore, unless they're in a position to find a Turkish speaker to go with them to act as a buffer, they often do not go. For the refugee applicant and recognized refugee, access to health care, I have to mention these hurdles maybe before I switch to this. Main hurdles accessing health care are poverty, fear of disease, fear of arrest and deportation, discriminatory practices of health care providers, lack of interpreters, stigma of being sick. Major healthcare provider is virtually the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and it covers the emergency healthcare costs of registered asylum seekers and refugees, which represent a very minuscule percentage of the overall immigrants. And others are the Social Assistance and Solidarity Fund of Turkish government, IAMP, and the Turkish Red Crescent. The major health problems are seemingly, the healthcare needs of this population seems overwhelming, but in fact they are understandable. Major health problems are attributed to malnutrition, poverty level housing, fear and insecurity. The effects of malnutrition and overcrowded substandard living conditions leave these people vulnerable to contagious diseases, especially to TB. Since 1965, the annual incidence of TB in Turkey has declined steadily with minor deviances, but has not fallen below 10 cases per 100,000, which denotes low-burden country as defined by WHO. Turkey is classified as a medium-burden country with the annual incidence of 24 per 100,000 in 2004, according to the Turkish Ministry of Health. Despite the fact that Turkey's annual budget is roughly $40 million, which covers free testing and treatment within 265 TB dispensaries and 21 chest hospitals countrywide, TB control is far behind what one would anticipate. Integration of DOTS as a national strategy in the primary healthcare system is a target still to be attained. Since 2002 and 2003 period, DOTS pilot projects were run in Turkey, but while the training and educational activities on DOTS were most successful and reached the majority of TB practitioners, there are still major shortcomings in the overall quality of laboratory services, monitoring and evaluation. Population served under the DOTS in terms of statistical data is ambiguous. Only 3 to 5% coverage range is estimated. It's a well-documented fact that marginalized groups carry an undue share of public health problems. According to several WHO studies, approximately half of the world's population, refugee population globally, is infected with TB. The 2005 WHO TB countries report revealed that majority of cases come from countries with TB incidence rates 3 to 20 times higher than Turkey. Maybe only the Iran is an exception. Of particular concern is this population lives with nationals in overcrowded urban slum conditions in the densest parts of Istanbul. Therefore, if TB is left untreated and if no attempt is made to break the chain of transmission, Turkey could potentially move towards the same TB epidemiological level as the high-risk countries of Eastern Europe. To date, there has been only one study on the incidence of TB on immigrants, among immigrants. That study brought to attention the increased rate of TB in foreign-born population, and it made an immediate call for a screening program for immigrants coming from countries with high TB incidence. This is the brief outlook of this study. Istanbul's Tuberculosis and AIDS program is a newly established community-based healthcare program in order to test and treat tuberculosis in the poverty-stricken immigrant communities of Istanbul. Excuse me. These communities include asylum seekers, refugees, and illegal immigrants. The first goal of the program is to enable all these communities who wish to be screened for TB to do so without fear of reprisal and regardless of their legal status. When one tests TB positive, that person is able to receive treatment in a clinic regardless of his or her legal or economic status. As this community is transient and extremely mobile, ITAP utilizes specific strategies like house visits and constant contact with the patient to try to keep him or her within the country until the end of treatment. The program aims at expanding its outreach to 24 satellite cities. ITAP is a joint program involving both the Istanbul branch of Turkish Anti-TB Association, IVCD, and immigrant community representatives. IVCD is a Turkish NGO which both screens and treats TB countrywide. It's been operating for 78 years and maintains 12 clinics in Istanbul. Consistent with their charter, IVCD has agreed to provide screening and treatment at four clinics in the neighborhoods of Istanbul where immigrants densely live, thus enabling ITAP to conduct the first TB outreach, education, and surveillance program. Key to allowing access was the IVCD agreement to lift two policies, requiring all clients to present a valid ID and lifting the fee for screening. These crucial steps have changed the help-seeking behavior of this population and removed the psychological barriers mainly rooted in the fear of detention and or deportation. To date, seven African migrant communities have assisted in the development of the initiative, mostly originating from African countries. Many studies show the fact that Africans suffer more than any other groups in Turkey by virtue of the color of their skin and poverty. Since September 2005 and 2006, ITEP have screened 237 patients, of which 17 have tested positive. Currently, 7 patients are on treatment. More than 42 house visits targeting 6 different language groups were made with the community reps, presenting educational materials on TB, nutrition, and beginning conversation about HIV and AIDS. As ITEP is a purely voluntary group, the only incentives and enablers offered are prepared telephone access, coverage of ancillary medication, transportation costs, and with the help of IVCD and IAMP, food packages, clothing, and blankets. So far, all services and facilities have been offered voluntarily and without funding. I would like to finalize my speech with prospects. As a part of EU accession, Turkey has initiated reform efforts addressing drug smuggling, human trafficking, and treatment of refugees. The Turkish National Action Plan is signed in March 2005 for the adoption of the EU acquis covering asylum and migration. Under this plan, Turkey is expected to lift geographical limitations by year 2012. The country is faced with the task of initiating legal and administrative organizations in order to align its migration policies with the EU. This process will pave the way for a more holistic and humane approach to immigration issue. However, considering to fortress European Union approach to immigration and social issues as a whole, the imagined picture of progress is not that optimistic. Intensified involvement of the World Bank and the IMF, coupled with the pressures of structural adjustment policies, have led and are still leading to privatization of Turkey's health system. There are many questions left unanswered, including the future of tuberculosis control. Within this blurred panorama, what is indeed optimistic is institutions like in IVCD commence to change their policies to accommodate the needs of at-risk populations. Immigration issue and asylum seekers flowing mainly through Istanbul are not temporary or transit phenomena because their stay is considerably prolonged. These processes affect migrants' life in profound ways. As such, irregular migration also affects Turkish society. With this in mind, small community health programs like ITEP should be supported. Hopefully, with intensified involvement of international cooperation in terms of humanitarian and financial burden sharing with the Turkish state bodies, initiatives will extend the dialogue on strategies to successfully carry on the battle against TB and HIV/AIDS. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you so much. We've been very fortunate this year, in addition to Yassine, to have others join us on our panel who first came into our knowledge through the Transmigration Working Group. And so we would also remind you that that's an important body of work where we can have an exchange of ideas. It was the occasion for us to meet most of the folks that you'll be hearing today. Next, I'd like to introduce Chris Gilpin. He's the chief scientist in the Queensland Microbacterium Reference Laboratory in Brisbane, Australia. The lab is the WHO Collaboration Center in TB Bacteriology. Chris performs lab capability strengthening in countries in Southeast Asia, the Pacific Islands, and Africa.
Okay, thank you very much. And also I'd like to thank you for inviting me to speak at this symposium today. So as a laboratorian, my presentation today is to focus on lab issues. The lab is always the neglected element in TB control, and it's also, with regard to migration, is an essential component. So what I'd like to look at is activities of the laboratory, some of the problems they encounter, and the impact and interaction of policy screening for migration and the role of the laboratory. So just briefly a little about migration and TB. You know, migrants represent nearly 3% of the world's population. Now, a lot of this migration is in-country migration within high-burden countries, such as China, where 10% of the population are mobile, moving from rural areas to urban areas. And these mobile people frequently have difficulty in maintaining good health. TB is a major concern, as one-third of the world's population are infected. But even though a lot of migration is within high-burden countries, there is a significant proportion of migrants who are travelling from high TB incidence countries to low TB incidence countries. Now, migrant screening has been the cornerstone of screening persons travelling from high prevalence countries to more developed countries, including the United States, the UK, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. So the medical screening involves all persons wishing to migrate undergoing a medical examination by a physician, and part of the screening is also to screen persons for various infectious diseases, including HIV, TB, and syphilis. However, these different countries use different criteria and tests, and this is particularly in the case of TB. Different criteria are used to actually screen patients persons for TB. And some of the questions that I'd like to propose is, you know, what works well and what can be improved. So the basic medical screening process firstly has the medical examination by the panel physician, and then the main screening tool for tuberculosis is the chest X-ray. And for virtually all programs, it's chest X-rays performed on adolescents and older persons. It's the first-line screening tool, but it has major problems in terms of sensitivity and specificity. And in fact, in a publication by Toman, it's estimated that 20% of active TB cases are missed through chest X-ray radiography. So, you know, we're starting off with a very imperfect screening tool, and then we're doing additional testing following that. And it's not an easy thing to diagnose, but we're working with imprecise tools. Other problems associated with the chest X-ray screening are the problems with inter-reader variability, depending on the experience of the person reading the chest X-ray. Additionally, comorbidity with HIV infection with TB further diminishes the reliability of the chest radiography for the diagnosis of pulmonary tuberculosis. So TB is classified according to these three groups here. Category A is the active tuberculosis, the AFB smear positive cases of TB. So from chest radiography, we see signs suggestive of TB or suggestive of inactive TB with signs of symptoms. And to confirm this bacteriologically, we need to actually have at least one of three sputum smears being positive. Or additionally, if culture is performed, a positive culture is suggestive of class A. B1, suggestive of active TB with signs or symptoms of TB. However, the microscopy is negative, no AFBs are seen. And the third category is B2, chest radiography showing signs suggestive of TB that is inactive with no signs or symptoms of TB. And no further laboratory testing is required in this group. So with persons that are identified in class A, what they need to do for travelling to the United States or the UK is they need to undergo treatment in their own country to make sure that they're rendered AFB smear negative. They still have ongoing disease that needs to be continued to treat. However, these persons are allowed to travel. Persons with B1, so they're AFB smear negative, but are still culture positive and are active TB cases, are still allowed to travel to the UK and the US. In contrast, countries such as Australia, New Zealand and Canada, which require microscopy and culture for all cases, would not allow these persons to travel unless they've completed treatment in their own country and a cure, bacteriological cure, has been demonstrated. So with the laboratory testing, following any abnormalities detected on chest X-ray, the requirements for the laboratory testing differs depending on host country requirements. As I indicated, AFB microscopy by three, so three early morning sputum samples are required to be submitted to the laboratory for AFB microscopy and staining, but for Australia, New Zealand and Canada, culture is required in addition to the microscopy. But there's lots of problems faced by the laboratory. Not only laboratories working in a DOTS program, and many of the problems are similar to those faced by a normal national tuberculosis program laboratory. But there's still unique problems associated with the testing of these samples from persons migrating. Now, one of the issues is the quality of the specimen. Now, often persons undergoing migration screening are not seeking treatment. They have been identified as part of the screening process as having some abnormality on their chest X-ray. Now, if you try and collect sputum from many of these patients, the quality of the sputum is not that of a symptomatic person who is producing purulent sputum or hemoptysis, but often the samples tend to be very salivary with only very small amounts of purulent flecks. Now, once this sample is sent to the laboratory, there needs to be a selection process. So you essentially have a very watery sample with a few purulent flecks. Now, the AFBs are going to be in the purulent sputum. They're not going to be in the saliva. So it depends on how the laboratory works in terms of selecting the purulent material to actually make the smear. So if you can't actually get the sputum onto the smear, you're not going to find the AFBs. And yesterday I heard it described that if you're looking for a black cat in a dark room, you won't find it if the black cat's not there. So it's a case of getting the appropriate material onto your smear, and then you have a chance of finding it. Other issues associated with the laboratory are direct versus concentrated microscopy. So because of the poor quality of the samples that you're getting, with only small amounts of purulent material, should laboratories consider digesting that whole sputum sample, concentrating it to increase the recovery of AFBs? The staining method used is another issue. Now, we've heard about this dinosaur test, the Zeal-Nielsen stain, that's been around for 100 years, but still there's so many different variations in the Zeal-Nielsen stain that we see when we go to different countries. It's the concentration of and quality of the basic Fuchsin stain, which is the key stain used in the Zeal-Nielsen method. There's differences in the decolorising method used. There's differences in the timing used. So even though we talk about this one simple test, the Zeal-Nielsen stain, there's so many variations and quality of staining that directly impacts on your ability to detect and detect AFBs in samples. Another issue is the type of microscopy that you use. The light microscopy is used for the Zeal-Nielsen stain. However, there's the fluorescent microscopy using the Auramine O, is recognised to increase the sensitivity of AFB microscopy. But regardless of what laboratory has the perfect testing tools, if their workload is excessive, the quality of their microscopy is going to be poor. So big question, should culture be used? And what are the advantages? The advantages of culture is that it will detect both smear positive and smear negative tuberculosis. So it will be able to detect all the prevalent pulmonary tuberculosis cases presenting for screening. If you can identify these active cases of TB, you can initiate appropriate therapy, and this will help to reduce the risk of TB transmission to persons in the host country. The other essential need for culture is to perform drug susceptibility testing. And this is particularly important when persons are migrating from countries with high prevalence of multi-drug resistance TB. But some of the disadvantages of culture is that it requires up to 6 weeks to actually grow these slow-growing organisms. And from the migrants' point of view, this may delay their travel. It's an inconvenient delay. Culture also is much more technically demanding than doing AFB microscopy alone, and there is the risk of false positive results due to laboratory cross-contamination. So is migration screening for tuberculosis effective? So I just want to quote this paper from Ted Cohen that was published in EID last year and reports on the incidence of tuberculosis among newly arrived United States immigrants from high tuberculosis prevalence country observed a significantly elevated incidence within the first years following migration. Now this is not something that's new. It's been recognised in a lot of studies that in migrants travelling from high burden countries to low burden countries, there is a significant increase in incidence within the first 2 years. But why should this be so? So I guess if we consider the natural history of TB infection, of those that become infected with TB, approximately 5% will develop active disease within the first 1 to 2 years following the infection. And then a further 5% will develop disease some years later. Now, the conclusion drawn from this paper was that the reason for this high incidence of TB amongst the newly arrived migrants was that they were being recently infected in their own countries, and so the natural course of TB disease would that you would expect them to, having recently arrived from a high burden country, that you are going to have a large percentage of them that are going to have active disease within the first 1 to 2 years. Other researchers have claimed that this high incidence amongst newly arrived migrants is reactivation of latent disease associated with peri-immigration stress, and that the trauma of leaving your home country to travel to another country, or even poor nutrition. However, I like to propose that part of the reason for this elevated incidence is that there's been inadequate case detection, inadequate screening in the country of origin, and so there are prevalent cases of TB which are not being screened out, and then these prevalent cases are allowed to migrate, and then they're referred to incident cases upon arrival to the United States or the UK. In another paper looking at the effectiveness of screening, and a paper by Sue Maloney, in a study of US-bound immigrants from Vietnam, found that screening by AFB microscopy alone yielded a sensitivity of only 33% compared with culture. So this means that two-thirds of the active cases of TB are allowed to migrate when AFB microscopy alone is used to screen out active disease. This suggests prevalent cases are being missed during the laboratory screening and are subsequently reported as incident cases upon arrival in the host country. So I'd just like to give you a little bit of an overview of the Australian situation and how the Australian screening policy differs from that of the UK and the US, and to see how effective that is in reducing the amount of TB which is brought into Australia and recognised as active TB within the first 1 to 2 years amongst long-term migrants. Australia is fortunate to have one of the lowest burdens of tuberculosis in the world. You know, we have rates of roughly 5 to 6 per 100,000 population, and these rates have remained relatively stable since the late 1980s. However, if we look at the incidence of tuberculosis among foreign-born persons, it's 20 times greater than among non-Indigenous Australians. So the Australian screening process uses the Australian health requirement, which requires a panel physician physical examination and a chest radiography examination for adolescents and older. Any abnormalities on the chest X-ray, AFB microscopy and culture is performed. If patients are identified as being category A or category B1, they must undergo a full course of treatment and have cure documented before they're allowed to travel. Any persons categorised as in category B2, so this is radiologically inactive TB, are put on a health undertaking process where they are notified to a TB program in Australia who are then followed up for a number of years. So in order to evaluate how effective the Australian system is in monitoring and screening TB migration, have looked at the number, or have looked over the last 10 years at the number of migrants from high burden countries coming to Australia, and looking at what was the incidence of TB amongst that group within the first 2 years. Now, if we just looked at the long-term migrants, these are persons who would have had the full screening process in their own country. So that all the prevalent cases under the Australian screening policy should have been weeded out. And looking back over the last 10 years, and we look at the number of long-term migrants that we've had, and the number that have had active disease detected within the first 2 years is less than 10%. So it's a very low rate amongst the long-term migrants. Obviously, we have other category, visa categories, such as overseas travellers and students coming for shorter periods. Certainly, we have a very high percentage of those persons who haven't undergone full screening for TB, showing active TB disease within the first 2 years. So a question to ask is, do you use screening for tuberculosis as a TB case inclusion or exclusion tool? So in Australia's situation, what we're trying to do is exclude TB. So you want to detect it in the country of origin, make sure it's treated, so that you're excluding as much tuberculosis as possible. If you're using it as an inclusion tool, so you're looking to screen only for the most infectious, those that have the smear positive tuberculosis, you then need to ensure that when these persons migrate to the host country, that there actually is the healthcare system there that can accommodate their needs, and to make sure that these persons can access that healthcare, the case holding can be performed and treatment can be initiated to completion. So from a laboratory point of view, what are the implications for human resource development? So laboratories in resource poor settings screening migrants will suffer from the same problems affecting NTP laboratories. It's inadequate working environments, it's poor remuneration, it's lack of motivation, lack of supervision. So we're starting off with our imperfect chest X-ray, then we're using laboratories which are not well resourced or staffed or equipped to do a rather insensitive test, AFB microscopy. Now, for laboratories actually doing migration screening, it's attractive to them because migrant screening is income generating. So the managers of laboratories may be interested in attracting migrant screening because it will bring in income, but are the income being generated from migration screening being used to adequately resource the laboratories, to adequately staff them, and which is an important consideration. There needs to be a sustained plan for training technical staff, and not only training them, evaluating that what has been taught has been learned. One way of ensuring performance and monitoring performance is through the use of external quality assessment, and this is the essential component for evaluating work performance. also can monitor laboratory performance through the use of laboratory performance indicators, such as smear positivity rates, the positivity rates amongst patients on follow-up. Also looking at the sensitivity of microscopy compared to culture. These are important indicators which should remain relatively constant within different laboratory settings and allow then different laboratories to be compared in terms of their performance in different countries. Finally, I'd just like to say that laboratory can often be the weakest link for the detection and diagnosis of tuberculosis. There's a need to understand the limitations of laboratories due to inadequate human resources, inadequate facilities, or excessive workload. Policymakers should also be aware of the limitations of laboratory screening of tuberculosis using microscopy alone, and laboratory performance always needs to be monitored using standard quality indicators. So thanks for your attention.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Dr. V.S. Salotra. Dr. Salotra is one of the chief medical officers in the Central TB Division of the revised National TB Control Program of India. Dr. Salotra has long years of clinical experience and has 5 years of experience of working with the world's largest national TB control program. Dr. Salotra.
I'll be sharing with you an experience of the referral for treatment mechanism, which was piloted for India for the patients who migrate long distances to seek their medical care at the medical colleges. First of all, the TB situation of India, we know that India contributes about 1/5 of the global incidence of tuberculosis, and there are an estimated 1.8 million new cases occurring in India every year. And from 1999 to 2006, we in the program have detected about 6 million TB cases, of which 2.2 million were new smear positive cases. And in the year 2005 alone, in the Indian program, it registered 1.3 million TB cases, and the new sputum positive case detection rate was 66%, and the treatment success was 86%. Coming to the medical care being provided by the tertiary healthcare centers, there are a large number of tertiary care facilities, including medical colleges, most of which are public medical colleges, and some are also private medical colleges. Because the patients have a big faith in these medical colleges, in spite of the decentralization of the services, the patients still go to these medical colleges for seeking medical care. And the patients travel long distances for seeking their care at these facilities. These patients, once they go to the medical colleges, once they are diagnosed, since they have traveled long distances, it is difficult to ensure and keep a track of these patients for start of their treatment. So the challenge is how to coordinate services to ensure that such TB patients receive seamless quality treatment under the national program. This is a picture showing you a view of the numbers of patients who reach these medical colleges for seeking health care. The upper picture shows the outpatient department, where there are a large number of patients and the facility is heavily crowded. And the lower picture shows the inpatient wards, where the patients are seeking treatment, getting admitted, and which are also heavily crowded. The contribution of the health of various sectors to the TB control program, the maximum numbers are being contributed by the public health sector, which is being depicted by the light blue bars, but the second largest contribution is from the medical colleges. The medical colleges contribute a large number of TB suspects. They also contribute to a large number of TB cases diagnosed, all the cases and sputum positive cases. But the percentage of the cases which are being treated by the medical colleges is very small. Once these patients are diagnosed at these facilities, they are referred back or sent back to the facilities which are nearer to their homes. We were not sure whether these cases are being registered under the program or they are going to other facilities or other health sectors. So because of these reasons, this pilot study was conducted with the objectives to pilot the RNTCP referral for treatment mechanism for medical colleges within the districts, between the districts, and between the states, and to assess the efficacy of feedback mechanism using standard referral forms via the postal system and through the patients. The medical colleges which were selected for this pilot study were, one was from Gujarat, one medical college along with four hospitals were selected for conducting this study, but this part was mostly belonging to the urban areas, and the population covered under the state Gujarat was 3.8 million. And the second area selected was state of Rajasthan with six medical colleges which belong to six different districts. The Gujarat was an urban area, but for Rajasthan, the population belonged to diverse urban and rural areas from six districts. For the purpose of the study, the formats and the registers were developed, printed, and distributed. The forms were printed in triplicate with postage stamps attached, and one form was given to the patient after his diagnosis when he was referred for the treatment. One form was posted to the district TB center where the patient was supposed to go for the treatment, and one was sent to the health facility which was nearer to the patient's home where the patient was to receive his treatment. And the feedback section of the form was posted back to the receiving unit from the from receiving unit to the referring unit. Training of the staff at the medical college and district TB center was conducted on this referral mechanism. This is a format of the referral for treatment register. Once the patient was diagnosed, the patient was referred back to the areas which were nearer to his house, and his most of his pertinent information was noted down in the register. And once the feedback was received for the patients having reached the center and initiated on treatment, this feedback was registered here. This is the format of the form which was printed in triplicate. One copy was given to the patient, one sent to the district TB center, and one to the health facility where the patient was to be treated. And once the patient reached there, the second part of the form was sent back as a feedback. This part, meaning thereby that the patient has reached there and was initiated on treatment. These are the results of the pilot. The results cannot be taken as comparable because for Gujarat, it is mostly the study was conducted in the urban areas, but for Rajasthan, it was a mix of urban and rural areas. The study period for Gujarat was 4 months, and for Rajasthan, it was 3 months. out of the 578 patients referred for treatment, the feedback from Gujarat was received for 73% of the patients, and for 27% of the patients, feedback was not received. Of the patients for which feedback was received, 63% of the patients were put on DOTS and 10% were not put on DOTS. For Rajasthan, the feedback received was much lower. It was about 40% and all the patients were put on DOTS, and for the 60% of the patients, feedback was not received. When we disaggregated the data for the feedbacks for referrals within the districts, for Gujarat, the feedbacks were received were much higher for the patients who were residing within the district. It was around 91%, and of which 78% patients were put on DOTS. While for Rajasthan, the feedback was received only for 45% of the patients. And if the for the triplicate forms that were handed over, for Gujarat, the feedback was received for the patient held form for 67%, and from the district TB center 55%, and from the peripheral health institute it was 74%, and for Rajasthan it was 33%, 34%, and 17% respectively. For the feedbacks received for referrals outside the district but within the state, for Gujarat, the patients who were referred outside the district, the feedback was 27%, but for Rajasthan, the data was not disaggregated. This data was included for the patients who were referred within the district. The feedbacks for referrals outside the state, for Gujarat it was 44%, but for Rajasthan it was only 4%. And the numbers were small for the patients who were belonging to the other state. And the feedback was better for Gujarat, but very poor for Rajasthan. For all the three forms, for Gujarat it was 17%, 27%, and 7%, but for Rajasthan it was 1%, 4%, and 4%. So the lessons learned from this pilot study were that it is possible to implement a referral for treatment mechanism under the program conditions. The results, however, for the feedbacks were highly variable. There was inadequate sensitization of medical college staff and faculty members and health staff, especially at the sub-district level, which led to poor understanding of the mechanism and lack of ownership at all levels. There was heavy dependence on the program's contractual staff for initiating the referral mechanism. There was limited information provided to the patients regarding this mechanism, which showed poor results, and the addresses recorded for the patients were in a few cases incorrect. The recommendations which came out of this pilot study were endorsed by the RNTCP Medical College National Task Force, which reviews the program implementation every year. And the recommendations were to scale up this mechanism nationwide to all medical colleges and hospitals and health facilities wherever there is a designated microscopy center where the patients are diagnosed. And before initiating this mechanism, sensitize all the key staff so that they are able to adopt it in a better manner. The medical colleges were also recommended to monitor their own program activities so that they have enhanced ownership of the program. It was also recommended to include the referral data in the routine RNTCP reporting and monitoring during RNTCP or the National Programs Review meetings, and to develop an electronic version of referral forms, which is ongoing. Taking recommendations from this pilot study, the RNTCP, the National TB Control Program, has adopted this referral for treatment mechanism, and in spite of initial difficulties, we assure that it is going to give good results as far as patient treatment and case holding is concerned. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to introduce our next speaker. Dr. Hamouda is a Sudanese medical doctor and epidemiologist. He's a member of the executive committee of the Sudan Stop TB Board. Dr. Hamouda works for the National AIDS Program and previously worked with Médecins Sans Frontières in southern Sudan and Darfur.
Okay, thank you. I feel privileged to be here. And I would like to recognize the presence of Hanadi. She is the head of the TB Patient Association. I don't see her here. But there is my colleague, Lauren Ali. In order to do this small study, we conducted analytical desk review where we looked into relationships and linkages between all these documents at the MOH, Sudanese TB Patient Association, and the some other humanitarian aid documents, poverty reduction, MDGs, and the interim constitutions. Also, we conducted some literature review on international human rights, TB and human rights, poverty issues, and access to health care and co-infection. Also, we conducted some consultation with key informants on the legal sector and health sector and civil society sectors. These are the findings of the review, that there is some contextual issues, some health issues, and some rights and civil society or civil liberties issues that are all linked to human rights and governance of TB patients in Sudan. And I mean, and I will detail all this, like the country is poor, there is some conflict, post-conflict issues, human rights issues, weak health system, and then the TB control, which was a breakthrough on this very poor country. And then we have the human right of the TB patient also, which was a transformative process in a country where the human right issues were a main concern. Sudan is a poor country. Population is 36 million. The country was in a civil war for over 20 years, and the peace agreement was signed in January 2005. All the economic indicators are very low. In fact, Sudan was ranking among the least developed countries in the World Bank Index, and the illiteracy rate is better compared to other African countries. TB annual infection rate is 1.8%, but I put an exclamation mark because there is now an ongoing tuberculin survey which might come with another annual risk of infection. HIV's prevalence among adult population is 2.6%. And the incidence of TB patient of HIV/AIDS among TB cases is 11%. The country is in an conflict in Western Sudan, but also in a post-conflict in other parts of the country. And this war has caused huge population movement in and outside country. These people, IDPs, refugees, they live in a chronic deprived situation where there is violence, but also this condition contributed to poor health status, particularly TB and HIV/AIDS. The conflict in Darfur already has stressed or put more stress on the already weak health structures. With the deployment of troops and other increased vulnerability factors, HIV/AIDS will increase, and with a consequent increase on TB controls. These IDPs and refugees that are suffering from lack of services, lack of clear policy, lack of protection, particularly for vulnerable groups and women, and they are mainly relied on international aid. The country also have a human rights concern. Most of the rights were suspended. So after the interim constitution, there is some fundamental right for press, for media, for association, and other civil rights. There is some social, cultural, and economic marginalization that was leading also to the war.
and there is some stigma and discrimination, social stigmatization of social groups, which will also fuel the stigma and discrimination against people with diseases. And there is also limited access to information and in general access to radio, televisions, and this also has impact on access to HIV/AIDS health information in general, but particularly HIV/AIDS, and also limited access to social services. Gender inequality is a major issue in Sudan, and it is an obstacle to poverty reduction and also protection of human rights, and women take the big part on stigmatization, discrimination, or even divorce because of their disease status. However, women make a big percentage of the small market, which you, the TB patient also use that as an opportunity, as I will show later. Poor health system. I mean, the cultural, economic, and social covenant requires that a health system with availability, with accessibility, with acceptability, and quality of care, is that is the health system who ensures the right of the patient. In Sudan, all these are limited. There is inadequate human resources, technical and financial resources, insufficient infrastructure and even distribution, and lack of proximity of these health services. There is also social restriction on women mobility, particularly in certain parts of the country, and also with the structural adjustment policy, there was the user fees introduced, and also there is a private sector where people go there for quality reasons, and sometimes that is the only facilities available, so they have to pay out of pocket expenses, which also is a barrier, particularly to women. Health behavior of personnel towards TB and HIV/AIDS patients, medical negligence, and lack of acceptance of treatment options and follow-up is another problem, and quality of health services where issues of confidentiality, privacy, and discrimination are lacking. TB control was a success story in Sudan. The pilot project, there was, I mean, a long history of TB control in Sudan, but the pilot project for the DOT was initiated with the IUTLD and WHO in 1993. By 2002, Sudan achieved DOTs all over with all the DOTs component in place, and all the DOT diagnostic centers and treatment center was there. Still, the case detection rate is far below the targets, and the treatment success rate is pretty close to the global targets. Partnered in the TB control with the TB Association, which was founded in 2002, where I will elaborate on that more. And then there was the DOTS committee, TB in the school, and TB clubs, and other partners. In 2005, all these partners, they came together and formulated what's called the Sudanese TB Board, which is an autonomous network of these partners. Sudan TB Patient Association was established in 2002, and in 2002 it was registered as a charity organization. This is a requirement by the Humanitarian Aid Commission in Sudan that all civil societies, they have to register, which is also an issue. And it's composed of TB patients who completed the treatment and other members, and it's chaired by a woman, which also, a good signal for inclusion. They have active branches in 20 states out of 25 states, and the main source of funding were from the Norwegian Lung Associations, from the private sector, and from poverty reduction, and from the government of Red Sea in Eastern Sudan, because this is a high burden state in Sudan. The association has regional, national, and international linkages. The association was formed to bring the TB patient back into the social life, empower and encourage them to combat social stigma. The objective are raising awareness of rights among TB patients through legal education, enable TB patients to play a leading role in TB control and advocate for human rights, improve economic and social status, and minimize social stigma. And they have conducted many activities, established patient association at the state level, conduct surveys on the status of TB patient, DOT strategy, capacity building, educate patient and care provider together. They bring both the care provider and patients, and then they have this training. Also increase participation as the national international forum and engage community in TB control. These are here a list of the activities that the TB patient has conducted between 2002 and 2004, where we see initially It was working on opening more branches for more support of the patients, and then training of this staff, and formulation of subcommittees later, and participation on advocacy days like the World TB Days or international days and conferences and political magazine. And they have this community awareness where they bring their communities in a group discussion, where community bring tea, coffees, and then they have this informal discussion around issues of health care, access, poverty, and the other concerns like water, sanitation. And also they have other partners who provide food assistance, particularly in deprived state like Eastern Sudan and Darfur in Western Sudan. And also they receive donation from the private sector, and they distribute these clothes, food items to people in Khartoum, IDB's camps in Darfur and in the south. They also they supported the women through a small enterprise cooperative, which they call a Sanduk, like a fund, where these women are co-own food processing machine, like producing spaghettis and meats, and then they sell them, and this particularly for women in IDB's camp in Khartoum. The Stop TB Board is another governance body for the TB patient in Sudan, established in 2005, as I said, an umbrella of all these actors, an autonomous network of partners where there is line ministries, NGOs, UN agencies, CBOs, and universities uniform. And this was really a success, because for the first time that we were able to meet the Undersecretary for the Finance. I mean, he's the one who was responsible for division of wealth and power with the South, but he gave our time for the board appointed the head of the poverty reduction as a key person in the board that represents the ministry in the board. The TB patients are in the executive committee of this board, so all the rights of the issue of the patient are ensured. The aim of the board is to reduce the social and economic burden of the TB and use strategies of social mobilization, communication, resource mobilization, and partnership. The board has a national, regional, and international linkage, and it is chaired by a professor who is also a public figure in Sudan and a head of university. To go to the human rights of TB patients in Sudan, I sought to define what are human rights. Human rights are dignified issues of a range of personal freedoms and access to vital material requirements. Some people, they prefer to group them into first generation human rights, which are political and civil rights, and second generation human rights, which are socioeconomic human rights. Example of freedoms are freedom from discrimination and mistreatment, to live together with one family, to participate in community life and decision making. And examples of vital material requirements like food, clean water, shelter, health care, and primary education. And the patient charter, which was introduced recently, they also have this list of rights where they put care, dignity, information, choice, confidence, justice, organization, and security. And when you go to the details, they are in the same classification, a range of freedom and material requirements. These elements of dignified human rights are inherent to all people, regardless of their race and other issues and other distinctions. And these human rights are ensured collectively by individual, by communities, local and national governments, bodies, and international entities. And they are ensured through national laws, international treaties, convention, and declaration. However, adherence to international human rights principles are uneven in the world. Particularly, women and children's rights are poorly understood or accepted in many parts of the world. Kaufman, in 2004, for his study for the World Bank, he finds that there is a causal link from third generation human rights, which is more political rights, to improve socioeconomic, and there was a strong linkage even between civil liberties and some diseases like the HIV/AIDS, which he put in a graphic representation, which he makes rights are very fundamental to disease response. Human rights in Sudan. Sudan has ratified and enacted to all international human rights I'm not sure about CEDAW, but that's the situation. And among this is the Covenant for Economic Social Rights, which details the right for health. There is laws, there is protocols for health laws. However, these health laws are outdated. The public health law was first introduced in 1912, and then it underwent a series of modification between 1912 and 1975, and that is the last time the public health law is modified. So now we have new emerging issues like TB, like HIV AIDS, and it's not there. And also the quarantine law is in 1940. So these are outdated laws, which will have huge impact, as I will detail later, huge impact on the patient rights. There was local governance law introduced in 51 and then amended in 1970 and 1993. And this is where most of the health services were decentralized to the states from the federal ministry of health. Nevertheless, these public health laws and other laws, usually they have the basic standard of care liability for negligence, and they have stipulated the need for mechanisms like to implement these laws, like the General Health Council, the Medical Council. However, there is no specialized unit within the Ministry of Health for legislation, and there was no mention for the Bill of Rights, of course, and or the charter for the care provider and the patients. This slide is over-presented, but before to proceed to the finding on the human rights, these are four cases where they came to the TB Patient Association seeking protection. Protection is to help people to ensure their right and to help government to ensure this right. The first case was about misdiagnosis and negligence. There was a repeated case of misdiagnosis and negligence, and then the head of the TB Patient Association went to this hospital and was talking to the doctors. Then an e-specialist, and he's a chest specialist, came to her and said, "Don't waste my time. Don't waste your time. The last thing is I would like to invest in is the health education. Give me the money that you have for the association, and I will know how to manage our patients." There was also this a young lady was supposed to get married, but her mother had a TB, and she's afraid that if the groom know, he will fly away. That's a Sudanese way of saying he just disappear and everything collapse. And they were in this dilemma, and then they approached the TB Patient Association. They were also concerned for the crowds that will come for the wedding. Usually they stay for days there. And then the association approached the grooms and the family of the grooms, and the issue was resolved. And even the woman was admitted, the mother-in-law was admitted to hospital, and nobody required that she must be present at the wedding. And the other cases was the work. This is a director of a governmental unit who was absent from work. Then he came back. He said, "I was absent because I was on this treatment. Now I feel better for my TB treatment." And all of a sudden, everybody was avoiding him. Even his office boy was not willing to come to the office to provide tea, water. And the director was in a bad state. He was depressed. He came to the association office crying that things need to be done, and he resigned from his post. Students, there was a female university student also. She was diagnosed with TB. She was deserted by all her colleagues. And even more, I mean, the student's affair advised her not to go to the classes, and if she go, they will take action against her. The head of association, she went to the student's affairs. They were not responsive. They say, "Please sit away. We know TB for generation, for 20 years. Don't intervene." So what to do? There was no law, no provision. So the TB Patient Association was adventurous. She sought assistance from a police officer that she knows. I just ask him that, "I want you to come with me to this office with your full uniform. Don't talk. Just I will talk," and then the issue was solved. Now this student is the head of TB HIV campaign at her university, and of course she was treated. And then the housing issues in Eastern Sudan. I mean, this is one of the marginalized part of the country, poor, even when people live in abject poverty. Some people, they just depend on porridge, salt, and oil for their food. So if a family member contracted TB, the house will be burned for hygienic reason. And if you don't have support, then you move to another village where you have relatives to live with. And this is putting further stress. the patients. So these are the stories of human rights concern. In a formal study conducted between the TB patient and HIV/AIDS patients, they were brought into a single room, and then they were asked about their concerns, their right concerns, their health concerns, and what is the suggestion. So they mentioned issue of their socio-economic status, they mentioned the education, the stigma, the medical care, and their rights, that to have rights stipulated, written, and psychosocial well-being. Also, they mentioned other issues like their finance for their work and policy makers, their involvement in the national response. When they asked about the tools and the measures suggested to improve the situation, they mentioned awareness and education programs and skill training and income generation so that they can be independent, and also they wanted laws addressing rights. This is particularly was raised by the people living with HIV/AIDS. Another study that we were part of was the Intergovernmental Development Agency. This was a cross-border studying for the TB, HIV, and malaria in border between several countries. And the finding for Sudan that policies addressing the cross-border population was lacking. There was lack of information about these populations, their movement and their behaviors and other access. But also the health services and facilities are inadequate and poor in quality and even require physical renovations. So in summary, There are major human rights concerns for TB patients in Sudan. There is inequalities, denial of access to health, particularly in marginalized areas like Eastern Sudan and West Sudan in Darfur. There is limited access to many health services, but particularly to HIV/AIDS care services. And there is lack and misrepresentation of information. The information is presented at national level. It's not disaggregated by regional level, where there is huge variation. And also there is failure to enact laws or to use laws that contradict with human rights, such as mandatory testing for HIV/AIDS, for refugees, for IDPs, and failure also to outdated laws. And also there is insufficient expenditure and misallocation of resources. I think the whole health budget is less than 2% of the national budget. Recommendation, TB patient associations, the Stop TB board and the National TB board, they need to join actions and to ensure that principle of non-discrimination are legally integrated into the health law, and to work towards setting up a mechanism to monitor health-related rights and other human rights issues, and also to engage civil societies, NGOs, and CBOs in the response, and to engage patient groups and to develop strong leadership at all levels, and to ensure that protective laws, particularly for vulnerable groups such as women and children, are ensured. Also, there is a need to provide free legal services for the TB and TB patient and HIV/AIDS, and also to link with international partners, particularly a mechanism to implement the charter and the international standard of care. The way forward. I just took this graph from a strategic planning and I modified it, where you have some incremental issues that the TB is MOH as part of the context at the bottom, they add. And then the innovative idea where patients were involved in the national response, and where also you have the community, so you move towards a bigger impact. But if we'd like to go to right-based approach, which is innovative, that is needs more. And I think there is opportunities for Sudan to move towards right-based approach. There is now this peace agreement with the devolution of power and resources for states. There is now the new poverty reduction budget, which is funded from the oil and from international partners and from within. And also there is now human and civil liberty movement. There is cooperative women lawyers, Khartoum Health Center. This all came with the peace. This also another opportunity. And also to link with the activist HIV/AIDS group, as a patient, as a charter, and all these international bodies. Also to tap on the global resources, the global funds, the global TB stop plan, and other the International Center for Research and Development. I would like to thank my colleague Laurent here from the TB board, and Hanadi from the TB Patient Association, and and my colleague Chris and Bailey from the International Rescue Committee who enlightened me on the human rights issues, and for the Deliana Fraser for allowing me to come here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Hamuda, will you join us up here?
Due to the good timekeeping of the speakers, we actually have quite a lot of time for questions and discussion. So if I can invite the speakers to come forward. And hopefully people have questions or comments or points for discussion. Please go to a microphone, identify yourselves and...
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's the last comment. So we'll do the advertising afterwards.
Thank you very much for this question. As I've told you, ITAP is a very small community-based healthcare program founded just in 2005. It's been only 1 year. And the program is purely voluntary for the moment, and we are looking for an international collaboration in order to be a sustainable program. And we need to share the experiences, particularly on immigration issues of people, representatives from NGOs working in different countries, different settings. If we extend our dialogue with these people and with this organization, we believe the coverage of the population, immigrant population, would be higher and ameliorated.
I'm sorry, I was late and missed the first presentation, but I was pretty much interested to know this health workers' brain drain. And I usually raise this at many forums and want to raise it here as well. If we focus with reference to the patients, we have different cure and different settings with the disease people. And can we use them as a resource? Is there any suggestion or procedure ongoing where we can use this force as a human resource, because they can be mobilizers, they can be trainers, they can be like community investment person and people, they have grassroots linkages with them. So I want to know your view on that. How we can use this force, like we have cured patients, we have people suffering with the disease, we have got many other forces. And my second question is to the last presenter, Ina. I really like your presentation, and I like the idea of the life-based approach. But my view is that at community level, particularly at community level, there are a lot many lacks, particularly people like who are suffering with a disease, they didn't know their rights. So is there any program in future for you to incorporate patient charter and ICT, and how we can go with the patient charter implementation? Thanks so much.
Obviously, I think many of They can spread awareness. However, I think when we're talking about workforce shortfalls, that there is obviously limitations where you can use community volunteers. I know certainly the program in India I have uses community volunteers, which includes cured patients a lot, as DOT providers. They also function as case detectors, but that's sort of a hidden role. But obviously, if there's no doctor or no laboratory technician, those are areas where that is a bigger issue. That I say there is a major role for patients and community volunteers, but obviously they cannot replace health systems. So there is limitations of use of patients and community, unless obviously they are doctors or healthcare workers, or the healthcare workers themselves. But there's the kind of limits. What we're talking about is actually there's no doctor, there's no laboratory technician, there's no nurse, there's no pharmacist. That type of shortages. And obviously, if that's not there, the service isn't there in many places. So yes, very useful resource, but limitations to what they can actually do if we're really talking about staff shortages.
Yes, I agree with you. I mean, at the community level, things are even complicated in Sudan because of illiteracy rate. And it's a very huge country. I think it's 10 times UK. I was in UK, so I can't compare, but I think it's even many, many times bigger as Europe. So issues of transportation and going to these communities, tell them about their rights. But last year we were here, and that was the first time we heard about the charters. And in fact, the discussion we had with the TB patient association that they would like to use the charter as an indicator because it is focused on the TB rights, where they have the issues of care, of access, stigma, and discrimination. So they will use that. They already had a negotiation with the cooperative women group. This is a group of lawyers that they provide free legal service in Khartoum and with the Khartoum centers. And also the head of the association now here is in the international conference. She attended this health communication with other three members. So we hope with all these trainings, they will improve their communications and their rights. Skills. I think there is a possibility that the standard care of treatment will get chance to be implemented because now the DOTS, the TB program is moving towards the quality phase where these elements are implemented. Also, they received this year the Global Fund grants, which also will give them some resources to implement. So I'm optimistic about that. The issues in Sudan, when you talk about rights, people always think about political rights, and which is a sensitive issue. The government is still controlling. We are not in a democratic government that accepts even the word of rights. So people need to be innovative, intelligent, and to convey the message that, yes, it is economic, social rights, but they are also linked. I mean, if there is no social civil liberties, you cannot ensure the human rights, but people, they need to be innovative and intelligent and clever also with the government.
Other questions? Sir, will you step?
I wonder what types of patients were referred. You know, most of the patients or tuberculosis are treated as outpatients without centers. They hardly require any hospitalization. So I would like to know whether there are any complicated cases, what type of patients are referred. Because in tuberculosis, you know, we are working in India, where 95% patients are being treated at DOT center. Hardly those who have some complication of tuberculosis, they are only referred to a hospital. And especially all the medical college hospital referral, the cases must be very, very complicated. Otherwise, they could be easily assigned to an ordinary district hospital or local hospital.
Actually, referral was not towards the tertiary care centers. The referral was from tertiary care centers to the periphery. For the patients who migrated long distances to seek their medical care at the medical colleges. These patients, once they were diagnosed, as suffering from tuberculosis. For the start of their treatment, these patients were referred to the peripheral health institutes where their treatment was initiated. Because the services have been decentralized, and once the patient has traveled long distances, he has to go back to the center where his treatment can be initiated.
There was a 40% patient that had treatment already in Rajasthan. 70% there.
That was about the feedback of the referrals. The patients, once they were referred back to the health facilities, the feedback was provided from the receiving units to the referring units. The feedback was about 40%, so the feedback was poor. It needs to be strengthened, and this is being taken care of by the program.
Please.
One person to the Indian friends from Bangladesh. We have also very similar experiences of referring back patients to the medical centers for the medical schools, hospitals. Do you have any kind of interventions or planning for reducing those kind of referral feedbacks? Because we have an experience of similar. And what you did is, we give the sealed stamp with envelope to the patients. When you go back, you don't need to write anything, you don't need to pay anymore. So just after reporting, ask the doctors to fill it out and then send back to us. It is improved, but still, 70-80% is coming back. Still, we really miss it. We have any plan for that kind of issues to be solution?
Yes, actually, during this pilot, the stamps were pasted on the triplicate forms. Once the patient reached there, the form was sent back, which was already paid for the stamp postage. And this mechanism, although it has not yielded very good feedbacks, but we have resolved to strengthen it by the development of electronic formats, so that this information, which is going through the patient or through the postage system, it reaches the health facility through electronic means, and the information is received back in a much faster manner.
Some of the presentation myself from Zambia. So I'm so interested to know what is happening. I'm from a district in rural Zambia, state district. And my question is, we have got very little support on the TB programs in our country, especially in the rural area. The doctors are mainly in the small districts, but there are some small hospitals in the clinics which I need also to equip with the microscope for TB programs. And there are so many TB patients who are responding to, who need to work on this program to give themselves as volunteers, as I am. So we've got some small groups which are not supported. I don't know the program, how we can have the access to those clinics so that they can have the program on those small clinics within some small districts in the rural areas.
Do you want to answer from the lab point of view? Or?
Yes, sure. Yes, so it is a major problem, and it's both resources, human resources, and financial resources to equip laboratories to give good accessibility for diagnosis and for treatment. So it is a case of seeking funds through things like the Global Fund in order to get your NTP to be better supported, to improve the access to treatment for people in remote areas.
I think there is a kind of difficult technical issue from the technical point of view, that and kind of in terms of treatment, and kind of treatment can be made available anywhere. The problem is that with the laboratory diagnosis, and I use a very extreme example, that you don't do heart surgery in every health facility for technical reasons, and that although smear microscopy is a very old and not very technical test, there are kind of issues around quality control, and that there has to be a certain amount of workload going through the laboratory to actually reassure you that the quality diagnosis is being made. So that certainly, and my experience in India and Nepal, in huge areas, that it is very difficult to provide microscopy centers in every health facility. One, staff and microscopes. The other is the technical issue. Now, there are other ways around it. That certainly, and the Rajasthan state has big, big deserts that are sparsely populated. Now, what we're trying to do is, instead of sending the patient to the microscopy center, you collect the sputum at the peripheral level and set up a transport mechanism to the laboratory. And that may be a way, in some settings, to get over the lack of technicians or the lack of patients. There is this issue that there needs to be a certain amount of workload to actually ensure quality. Now, as I say, I don't know the situation, obviously, that you're discussing, but maybe we need to slightly think differently, and that certainly the training of health workers also may need to be looked at to actually be based on the reality of the health setting and the disease setting. It's just a thought and a different way of maybe tackling the problem that you're raising.
Any other questions? If not, before you leave, Fraser,
I stopped Einar doing the advert, right, before people, more people leave. We would thank everybody that turned up today, especially those that turned up at 8 o'clock. And kind of the advert is tomorrow, kind of the working group, the Trans-Border Migration and TB Working Group meets tomorrow at lunchtime, 12:45, 13:45. And if this is room 343, then the meeting actually is back here. Our two topics as yet that we would like to discuss is kind of there is a draft paper looking at and kind of undocumented migrants and their care, mainly in developed countries. Now, we are working on this to actually put it into the public domain as a published document and a statement to the union. So please, if you're interested in hearing the work that has been done, please turn up. The other one is obviously looking to next year, that one of our main activities is organizing kind of our almost annual symposia like today. So please, if you're interested, turn up tomorrow, same room, 12:45, the working group.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.